Sunday morning marks 50 years since a police raid on an unlicensed club in Detroit led to unrest that lasted 5 days. When it was over, 43 people were dead and entire neighborhoods were burned to the ground. And the Motor City's trajectory was changed for the next half century. Joining me now is MSU Professor of Sociology, Dr. Carl Taylor, and he has thoroughly studied Detroit and other communities over the many decades, and welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
I know that was a shortened bio.
You're very kind. No, I'm fine.
I want to ask, you are a Detroit native. Where were you on that day in 1967?
Well, I have a very good memory, period, but I remember that day forever. I was coming out of church at noon, and I grew up in that neighborhood, and you could see the smoke. I was on Davison, and so it was about a mile away. You could see the smoke at noon. It was a beautiful July day. And you could not only see the smoke, you could begin to feel the energy, the negative energy, and you knew something was happening that was very different. I was 17 years old.
And what were the next few days like?
They were surreal. They were a complete antithesis of what I had grown up and known. Unlike some Detroiters or young men, I certainly had a different, I would say, understanding of police. I was not afraid of the police. I had a very, I'd say, a great childhood and growing up, so suddenly to have my school complex, which is Central High School, is where the 101st Airborne had landed. That was their command post there. You had tanks, jeeps. It was a war. And that was totally like nothing I had ever seen before. So you had jeeps going up and down the street, tanks. I'd never seen a tank live moving outside. I'd never seen one live. See it in the movies. And then there you had, you could tell the difference in the 101st Airborne, who had just returned from Vietnam, which was a different soldier. There was a combat, they had already been in combat, opposed to the National Guard, who were weakened guards at that time. I don't know if you would say that today. So then you had the local police, the Detroit police, then you had the Michigan State Police, and of course you saw an assortment of other law enforcement agencies. So you're seeing all this, and we were, a curfew went into play, and you heard gunshots at night, which was, all of this was just surreal. This is totally different from anything I had ever experienced, ever.
You were 17 years old at the time. How did that change your outlook, or did it change your outlook going forward?
Absolutely. At many different levels. I was not racially sensitive. I didn't know, and some people perhaps would laugh, but we actually had a very diverse community. I remember I had a very good friend named Victor Lim, who's came from a very affluent family. He was related to a restaurant owner who had a very, one of the best, if not the best, Chinese restaurants downtown Detroit. Victor was my friend from elementary school. We weren't tight in high school, all right? I had another young man by the name of Lyle Smith who was white, lived behind me. There was, our next door neighbor was a couple with no children, German, Catholic, the Gosses. Mr. Goss was the last of the hands crafting, making artificial limbs. Their child was a parakeet named Timmy. So she had a humongous garden. Her and my mother exchanged. And so it sounds like I'm kind of describing almost a utopia. It wasn't a utopia, but it certainly was not filled with violence. It's nothing like the stereotype of urban hellhole that represents many times, unfortunately, Detroit neighborhoods today. So it was a pivotal day in my life. I was preparing to come here as a freshman, and so July, and back then school didn't start until the end of almost the end of September. And back then, schools were not in motion until after Labor Day. So when you ask that question, you know, our stores were burned out, our neighborhoods were gutted. It was a very, just surreal destruction that it was just unreal. Like, what happened? We were working class folks. Again, despite the stereotypes of everybody's on welfare, we weren't that. And also, I had to come here. It was kind of surreal today coming here because you're having student orientation. So the riot took place on the 23rd, and I had not came to student orientation here yet. So that was very, very, very sensitive and different. So when I got here, and you tell somebody else, you say, where are you from? And they say, well, you know, they're white, and the Muslims, you know, I'm from all over. First time seeing international students. But more importantly, you begin to get it little by little that everybody was looking at you because you're from Detroit, and that's where the rate, you know, you had the rebellion, the riot, insurrection. People become sensitive about what it was called, but it was the biggest change in my 17 years, and I would say even over the last half century, it remains, as a researcher, I'm still amazed at what took place.
And when you say coming here, of course, you mean Michigan State University.
For right.
People listening. And I was just going to ask you about that. Some people say riot. Some people say uprising, rebellion, mm-hmm. disturbance. Right. What do you say, and what's the difference in terms to you?
Well, a riot is totally out of control, and it's more of a reaction. It could be, and then that's what it was, pent-up reactions by some. I think some people were rioting. I think the unfortunate part that America did not realize that there were many solid citizens, working-class folks, like my folks. I remember coming home from church. We had church, you know, you had church clothes, and got out of my church clothes, and I wanted to go up on 12th Street because the street was just abuzz with people in shopping carts, and they were, you know, at TVs, and they were breaking in pawn shops. They were breaking in all the stores. So foolishly, and I say foolishly because I should have knew better, I'm getting ready to hop off the porch, and my mother said, where are you going? So I'm going up on 12th Street. You know, look what everybody was, a free fall. So it was rebellious also that some people were actually angry. I think I say as a researcher, but even then I could understand that this is strange. Who are these people and why are they doing this? And it really was the social levies visually. They burst. And when I say that, we segregate the poor, we segregate by race. It was a class issue. It was economics, but it also was social. There were families like my families, many of them, who absolutely refused to participate. They had no reason, but they were stakeholders. And I think that's what people didn't understand. It was those who were not stakeholders, and I'm not giving them an excuse, but it made sense. It also made sense that I better, my brothers and I, we better sit down on that porch because we were raised that you can get whatever you want, you have to work for it legally. And then there were those who, as a researcher, I could go back and I was amazed to find the anger, the rage that many had, the resentment towards a society that had forgotten in them. And that is very true. So I say take your pick in labeling what it was, but it wasn't good. I can tell you that.
I was just going to ask about what were the underlying kind of issues or causes, because doing my research, you know, people thought, and of course there were issues in the 40s and, mm-hmm. and
well, 43, you had the worst race riot in the history of America. And so in 67, that was the worst civil riot. And so someone would ask me the difference. 43 was race. It was just race. Detroit was very segregated. It still is segregated. Historically, Detroit has been a very segregated, and at times considered the most segregated region in America. So that was there, and race was there. And so the difference was significant. And in 43, it was dangerous. People were killed. Of course, in 67, we had the worst civil riot up until the riot in Los Angeles in the 90s. It was very puzzling because it destroyed more than simply the stores. It It destroyed our family structures. But we also discovered as a researcher that we had these dysfunctional families that we had no idea. And yet, when I look back, yes, we did. I remember on my street, the Taylor boys were community property, meaning that if you as a neighbor, and Mr. Hartwick was there, and I was going to school, walking down the street, and you say, hey, Carl, come here. I need you to take this trash out to the alley or whatever. I'd stop, put down my baseball glove or wherever I was going or my books, and did what you asked. And that was it. You better not give me any money because I was not allowed to take money because my mother insisted upon that I don't raise you for myself. I raise you for society. So that sounds like a cliche, but it's very important. What I found out, and remember commenting to my mother much later, that you know what, your playbook is not a playbook in rearing children that's shared by everyone. So school was very sacred. I went to Central. I went to Roosevelt Durfee and Central, which ironically is the same place that Eli Broad, who's our great philanthropist here in the museum and so forth, but he went to Central. Harriet McAdoo, prolific researcher, she's passed now, she went to Central and graduated in 57. And I was making a comment to someone that it's a replica of Oxford in England. So it's a humongous campus. It was the first high school that was really serious in, I don't know, it was in Michigan, I think so, the serious high school. Central was very profound. But when I began there in 58, I was 8 years old, I went there and it was a, considered that we had moved up when we moved in that neighborhood, it was predominantly Jewish. The institutions, the business, all of that was intact. So I went to school that spring. It was 95% Jewish. And when I came back that fall of 58, it was 95% African-American. There was a massive exodus of the Jewish community. The infrastructure was still there. You still had Jewish merchants. But I lived directly across the street on Elmhurst from Beth David Synagogue, which was a huge synagogue. And I didn't know, the Detroit News did a great expo on it, that the Jewish leadership led by the rabbis had a march around the block because they were leaving. It was the exodus. And they got out of there. And that was part of what has troubled Detroit, you know, the massive exit of whites, you know, and even today, the Catholic community was very strong in Detroit. And so visitation, that the school, prior to the Catholic school was there, the rec center was there, a major player in my neighborhood, you know, boys club and all those things. And today there's nothing there. It's like the Beatles song, Eleanor Rigby, you know, where all the lonely people, that means just nobody there.
You know, some concluded the violence that broke out was partly because of miss signs. Are there miss signs in today's Detroit, today's Michigan?
I think there's miss signs in today's America. And I think absolutely there's miss signs. We've never been, I think, as a myth of what we were. That includes the way I was raised. And I was raised, as I say, quote, as a good boy, and they're good boy and good girls, which I think that in many ways somebody would probably laugh and think I'm naive. But as a kid, I related to, I had a very simple life. Walt Disney on Sunday on television. Ed Sullivan was an hour of entertainment for America, family entertainment. And it was a big deal in our home or in my community when the Temptations and the Supremes appeared on Ed Sullivan. The whole community would be surrounded by the TVs because we were Negroes then. And was a, you know, these were victories that we would see our own entertaining on television. And so we could sleep on the porch, you know, the air conditioners was the trees. We had a lot of trees and there was no one harming you. You could sleep safely on the porch. We did not have a drug problem prior to 1967. As a city and as a researcher, unlike some of the other big cities, we didn't have a heroin epidemic. So when you ask that question, I look at even now, we have this big, I think it's good, but this big public health alarm about drugs, opioids, and so forth, right? We now have emergency workers and even police departments carrying EpiPens to help bring back those who have gotten entangled in these drugs, right?
Right.
But in fairness, if we look at Michigan and we look at other states, other cities across America, you think of, I do as a researcher, I think of Billie Holiday, who was a heroin addict, who had her cabaret card taken from her. Without that cabaret card, the same as Charlie Parker, these are jazz greats, they could not work. There was no such thing as, oh, we got to get an EMS and an EpiPen. They were labeled as junkies and a threat to society, and they were in prison. No one was speaking of treatment, you know, for these. So to me, there's a hypocrisy there. I favor strongly drug treatment opposed to penalizing them. But then Detroit got hit hard by heroin after 67. It looked like 67 was the pivotal turning point that we began to have really horrible things happen. We had the drug epidemic where we started having a lot of property crime. We had the import of Japanese automobiles, which disrupted automaking, manufacturing. Before, we were nothing but American cars. We had Volkswagens for college professors and college kids, the Beetle. But outside of that, you drove American. You know, we had Vincent Chin, who was murdered, beaten to death, and he wasn't even, and he was a Chinese American, and he was not a Japanese, and he was beaten by two white men who were workers of the auto industry. I remember in Detroit, even as a researcher, if you had a foreign car, you could not park your car in certain places because the unions were so strong. So we're living in a different America with many of the same problems that we had a half century ago. And in some ways, we're very blatant and nasty about it now. You know, we have a divide right now. The nation is very divided along lines, anti-everything, sexuality. There's so many things. So it's a mix. It's a mixture that's, I find, alarming that we got a lot of work.
Did you choose your study of sociology? Had you had that before you came here to MSU, or was that partly affected because of what happened in your neighborhood and your city?
That's a great question, and I can't answer it. I mean, in a sense, I say that I'm laughing because I think that, honestly, I believe that I was drawn to this work. My work was in criminology, but all of this just unfolded to me. MSU was an experience that was just great. And it was very painful when I first got here. I grew up in a black community with white, integrated with white people. So it wasn't pseudo-black, you know. I was not afraid of white police or white people. I had white teachers who were very, very good. I had black teachers. I had Asian teachers. So I just saw people. It was just a different thing. Then I got here, suddenly I became a ghetto child, which I, to this day, still resent. Do you understand? It's like, you know, you're from Detroit, you're from the ghetto, and you don't know anything. You know, you're a thief, and that's the way we were, you know, it was very... And then some of it I found, ironically, that I had a lot in common. My suite mates were from Iron Mountain, Michigan. I remember they were twins, and they were wrestlers, and they were having just a difficult time adjusting to MSU as me and my roommate, who we both were athletes also. And so we had excellent teachers, but when we got into the classroom, I began to see things that suburban students had that we had never seen before. For example, we had natural science. So we had globes, yes, all right, when I was studying, but then they had this oddity that I didn't know what in the world it was, and it actually was the universe, and it had all the planets, and it was fixed, and the kids from the suburbs knew, they were exposed to it before. We were sitting there looking at each other like, what is that? And so there was a lot of pain feeling to be ostracized, to be stigmatized. I'm used to black radio. Black radio was very important. Martha Jean, the Queen Steinberg. She was a black woman who was a pioneer. And on Fridays at noon, she played the blues all the time. She played the different, I wasn't crazy about the blues at all, as I was into Motown. But on Friday, she would give a warning to the women that it was payday because of the auto workers. And she said, you know, the eagle flies on Friday. And that meaning that, you know, so you women get to the gate of the factories and get that money before they go to the bar and get dressed up and prostitutes and, you know, nightlife. So there was a service that Black radio played in our community that was more than simply entertainment. It was education. She spoke the language, and she spoke to young people or to parents. And so we looked to that. And suddenly now we're in an age of we're lucky if there's even a disc jockey from, there's no more local radio. And in many ways, automation has replaced everything. So you may be listening to techno music, and there's no DJ there. Or for the first time now in the last decade, we've been having popular national like Steve Harvey or Tom Joyner, who's someplace else. Right. But I would contend that I got up in the morning and those disc jockeys were part of my life and I was listening to them. So not only was I listening to the Temptations and that music, but they also were giving where to go buy something, or if something went wrong or there was an emergency, what to do as a family. They talked about the ride. The radio was very important, and that's no longer the case. We have, you know, modern radio. So a lot, we've given up a lot in the face of technology.
And that was kind of an adjustment you had to make at MSU because there was not that at the time.
Absolutely. Well, I was caught in between a rock and a hard place, Reginald. I have to say that. When I say that, I yearned for a home. I yearned for all those we laughed because we were, when I came up, there was no McDonald's in our community. But there were literally, you know, plenty of mom and pop shops. And so in many ways, I was like Fonzie. It's just that, you know, or Leave It to Beaver. People would laugh at me, but there was a lot of things that were duplicated that were there, you know. And the merchants, you know, we'd be up on Linwood, where I went to school, the Nation of Islam, the Black Muslims were right across the street, and they had their school. And I saw Ali there when I was on the football team. I went to Detroit Central, and Ali came, and then he was Cassius Clay, and then he, you know, converted to Islam and to the Nation of Islam, and they stopped the traffic on Linwood Avenue. That was a big day for us. All the schools were right there in a row. The elementary school, which was Roosevelt, Durfee Junior High, and then Central High School. Interesting enough, we had a very strong class issue. I went to school with the first Black city councilman, William Patrick. His daughter was Michelle Patrick. So I went to school. I was a working class child, but I went to school with the Black bourgeoisie. And that could be very difficult. I remember, if you saw the movie Dead Presidents, I was laughing because we had milk boxes because we had a milkman back in those days. And they had a metal box that would allow the milk to be placed in there and not be frozen in the winter, you know, or it kept cool in the summer because this was this metal insulated box on our porches. So the milkman, he had a very stinky cigar. He was Jewish, and he was a great guy. You know, we had this, do you understand what I'm saying? So the postman, the mailman, I'm talking about community connections. And as a child, we were community property. That, in other words, Mr. Hartwood could get after us, you know, and the only thing we would say, I got caught one time. I know I'm going to surprise you. I was profane, and I was little, and I was talking, and a neighbor caught me and got another buddy of mine in the alley, and we were cursing at each other. And I got a big kick out of it. So when she got us, she, you know, let us have it. And then she says, I'm going to let your mother and father know. And I was like, oh, I was on my knees. I was begging her, please do anything. I'll work for you for the rest of my life, but don't call my parents. So you do understand. And today, that's, you say something now, we got parents going to the school, beating up the teachers. And I just had an incident where a parent chased the principal down the alley, which was very difficult for me. I was like, what?
And what was interesting is that it was a multicultural, because I've heard in the Black experience, especially my parents, when they were in more or less segregated kind of communities, you know, the Black community operated as a village, but you're saying it was even a multicultural experience.
It was multicultural. I would say Detroit. I would say that cliche. I did a lot of work with the Children's Defense Fund with Marion Wright Edelman, and who's actually Hillary Clinton's mentor. But Marion is a great civil rights activist. But we use that metaphor of village. But as a researcher, I would say very strongly that yes, that's true. But we don't talk about there were bad villages, and there were bad folks. I mean, when I say bad, not to stereotype, but, you know, we talk about assets, you know, and human development, you know. So all children need adults in their life. Yeah, but they need the right adults in their life. And you have to be very careful not to stereotype. I had many people that I'm indebted to forever that had no college education, that were good, hardworking folks. And all they wanted was a progress report. You know, how you doing up there? You know, we're counting on you. And even when I got my doctorate and even in my research, a lot of the information that I get, and I strike back very fiercely in the academy, in the ivory tower, don't you dare call that anecdotal to me. Do you understand? Because anecdotal is a nice elitist way of saying that you're not as important. I say those are oral histories, and I respect those people quite a bit. And there were many African Americans who served their country and bought their homes on the GI Bill and went to work in the plant. And they were good citizens. They went to church on Friday. So they should be given the same respect as the Polish American, Jewish American, Hungarian, Asian Americans. It doesn't matter. But that's not how we work, unfortunately. And so that's what I see a lot. But yeah, it was always multicultural, to answer your question. Yes.
When was the last time you visited the neighborhood you grew up in, and what do you think of it now?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a tough question. I always keep a second resident in Detroit as a researcher. I was, and I'll have to send it to you. My brother is heading up a project called Urban Requiem, and I had taken my graduate classes to my old neighborhood. It's a very, probably, I would have to tell you, one of the most powerful and excruciating experiences to go back to my old neighborhood, which is abandoned. There was a person squatted in our homestead, and my brother was there, and I had a colleague who's from China, and she was very curious, and I had that vibe. I sensed that it didn't look like anybody, you know, the house was abandoned. We knew it was abandoned. And then I said to my brother, somebody's in our house, you know, in our house. I still identified, and they were. And there's bootleg electricity, no running water. That was 50 years ago, immaculate lawns. And I can say that because my brother and I, and particularly me, I'd cut half of the lawns on that block because that's how you hustled. You know, you could do that. We had a lot of trees. The city had street cleaners. You know, you couldn't park your car on the street that day because they had these big, humongous street cleaning. They washed the street. We had such a sense of community, block clubs, this time of the year that you had to get a permit from the city, but they blocked off the street to put wooden horses up. And people would have hot dogs for the kids. And the block club sponsored a Little League baseball team. We were very organized. And that school was very much the heart of that community. Because a lot of people went to school after school, night school, but they also had for the community at large, where they had courses like reupholstery and pottery and, you know, the things that we talk about, extension and so forth. So when you look at these neighborhoods now and how it looks now, and I'll send you the pictures, I'll tell my brother, it breaks my heart because you're looking at a 50 years. When that riot happened, it was like someone bombed it out. I call it urban ruins, and it hurts. I'm just going to be honest with you. It's like that's a part of my life. I become very distraught, and you're not supposed to, as a sociologist or as a researcher. You know, you want to be objective. It's impossible to be objective about looking at a picture that you're a part of. Do you understand? You I'm biased. Am I biased? Yeah. I had my graduate class there, and I took them up to where my school was, and I had no idea that my elementary school had been razed. It was gone. And as a matter of fact, NBC was with me that particular day, and they were filming my work, you know what I'm talking about. And the camera guys said, where can we get a good sandwich? And if you had asked me that 50 years ago, I'd be wondering, what do you want? You know, we had Chinese food. We had, there was a place called Major Barbecue on Davidson and Linwood for 99 cents. And then, of course, now we're talking 1965. But for 99 cents, you got a small whole chicken, French fries, coleslaw, and toast for 99 cents, you know. So you had all these choices. Where we date, we didn't have cars as young men. We walked, or we caught public transportation. There was no Lyft. There was no Uber. You saved up your money in taxes. Street lights dictated curfew for us. You better be back at home when the street lights. We enjoyed our summers. We loved our summers. That's all gone. And so some people, I call them diehards in my research, that I have a young man whose family in 1949 was the first black family on Highland Avenue. He is a well-educated, he got divorced, and he's back there. His mother lived to, she was 104. I don't know how he does it, because at night, and some people may not like the description, but at night, it's just downright scary. I saw recently, you asked me, I think that's been my research site. I went this past spring and saw two wolves. Actually, and Mother Nature is retaking, you know, the concrete. The you know, we don't have alleys anymore. When I was coming up, not only did we have alleys, our alleys were clean. Now the sewers, everything, the infrastructure has crumbled in these neighborhoods. So they've done an excellent job in recreating and rebuilding Midtown and downtown. In Midtown, I'm very much, there's a research in Midtown and downtown, crime is down 59%. You know, you could get naked and be drunk, seriously. And nothing's, and if something does happen, there's private police, and then there's the Detroit police. But if you get in trouble down in those neighborhoods, forget about it. They have been abandoned. They're like ghost town. And if you knew what was there before, like I do, it's, I, you know, I'm asking the people that I call diehards, they haven't done anything wrong, Reginald. You know, I mean, they haven't done anything wrong. They paid their taxes and they just got stuck there. So he's the first black family on Highland. And now, and I did a study for the Social Science Research Council, we were counting houses. So most of your blocks you look at, you're looking at perhaps between 50 to 60 houses when you look at both sides of the street, about 25 houses on one side of the street. Apartment buildings, some, you know, very well kept. On his particular street, there was no apartments, but mainly single dwelling households, almost all of them. And now there are, including his house, there are 8 legally occupied homes. And then there are 23 abandoned houses that are being squatted. And so squatting can range, which I show in my research. They can range from, you can look there and say, oh, someone lives there, and you don't know if they're squatting or not, but they, you know, they fix it up and they're squatting. And then they get into this weird, this is my house and there's these weird laws. And so, you know, you got mental health issues. And then you have others where it looks like nobody lives there and they are occupied by those who are entangled in illicit narcotics, they're drug addicts. And so it's scary and it looks like something, it looks like zombies, you know, and I hate to say that when you step back and begin to understand a classic movie, you're going to laugh. I call it what it is. It's really the classic. As a matter of fact, the producer just died the other day. Night of the Living, what was it?
Night of the Living Dead.
Yes. Yeah. So who are the zombies? And I think we have seriously zombies because they've been abandoned by everyone, you know, including the church. Nobody wants them. The black church, the Catholic church, these, no one wants these people. So those people come out at night. And if you run into that, that can be very, very scary for the eye, and it can even be dangerous. And I'm not saying they all are dangerous, but I think for many Americans, regardless of where you're from, they have no idea people are living like that.
Right. You went from community 50 years ago where you could sleep on your porch outside to a place you would be afraid to go. Most people, a lot of people would be afraid to go.
You can't even believe it, Reginald. I mean, really, we left the back door, the screen door. All we had was a little hook on the screen door, and you left it open because you got good natural breeze. You had the trees, so we didn't need air conditioning. We had hot summer days, of course, not like the weather now. But do you understand? And, you know, then Mr. Softy came, and we had the Egg Man. The Egg Man came one day. Then we had a Produce Man. So, you know, they're giving us fresh produce. The stores had produce in front of the store outside. No one stole those produce, all right? And so our mothers, there were not all these fast food and the technology, you know. Women who made rolls, they had to make them from scratch. And so there's a lot of pluses with the changes today, but those changes never landed in our community. Now we go up. I'll tell you something very interesting quickly, that I'm on Davidson, and I'm up there, which is in the neighborhood, and there's a fast food mecca. They're all back-to-back. Church's Chicken, White Castle, Caesar's Pizza, all of that is there. Here's the frightening part. Children, a lot of kids that have parents who are dysfunctional through drugs, stuff, that is the mainstay of their meals. You know, you're not getting healthy. That food is not good for you. And so you don't have the grocery stores. Where I came up, we have fresh produce, like I say. Construction workers, guys be working in the street. They go in and get four slices of bologna. Good bologna. I'm sorry, there is a such thing, I think. A box of saltine crackers and cheese. And, you know, you saw them and so that was it. Yeah, Kool-Aid, of course, we know it's not good for you. You understand? Right. But you could live a good life, and that's what I'm saying. And the main thing that I think is gone now is the hope. When I'm in those communities and I'm looking at this dysfunction, I call my new book, my new study is called The Third City. And so you understand I'm saying that segregation brings up. These are the voices that are not heard. And what we found out when I began this over 20 years ago, I thought the third city was simply Detroit, Black City, or urban cities. Now we realize that that is also, it can be an Arab community, the have-nots, and it can be immigrants coming in from Syria or someplace. They have to get on welfare, and some get on their feet, and they do, and some don't. But the third, it's a third-rate citizenship. They are, I break it down into citizens, non-citizens, and anti-citizens. There's that bitterness, that backlash. Could we have another riot today? They don't have nothing to burn down. Just they're going to re-burn what they already burned. And, you know, and I have blocks that, like I told you, that I am very serious. That the whole block has disappeared. Do you understand? I mean, just there is nothing, just either barren land or wickedly decaying buildings. And to go back 50 years, and this was a working class neighborhood with good people sitting on the porches.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Carl Taylor, sociology professor here at MSU. It's been a pleasure, and just thank you for your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
For WKAR News, I'm Reginald Hardwick.